at least make things consistent, if not allow our reporting into one system to cover all people who need the data, that's the direction that we're headed in. And so I think with that, I'll, Peter, I'll stop and see if anybody has any questions.
Any questions for Bill? Okay, Bill, thanks so much. That's very informative as well. And I'll also keep my comments quite brief. The NQF has a variety of safety initiatives underway, one of which is processing a number of recently submitted patient safety-oriented measures for endorsement. And within that, we have a subsection on HAI, and we're moving those measures through in an expedited fashion in order to help facilitate CMS's use of NQF-endorsed measures in their activities next year, as well as working with the other federal agencies. And in particular, that CLABSI measure that's been submitted under NHSN by CDC is in that pile. And the expectation that is that endorsement will occur as we go through our public comment phase. Similarly, we continue to work with ARC in terms of the review of the public comments on the common formats, and that's turned out to be a very strong relationship overall. We have our framework report that I mentioned earlier coming up for board approval later this week, actually, is the board meeting. And once it's out there, it'll be certainly available for strong public consumption. And I would, again, encourage you, if you haven't, to have a look at that framework report, because it will form a strong platform for public reporting across the country. And remember, the federal agencies are looking at it closely, and we hope that state-based groups will as well. And then a particular interest to this group is certainly the ongoing work of the Serious Reportable Events Steering Committee. We've had a strong review of the existing 28 serious reportable events underway. We have 11 newly submitted serious reportable events that have been submitted. And there are, in addition to the hospital environment, these other three environments that we've expanded into: skilled nursing facilities, ambulatory surgery, and office-based physician practices. And the inputs from our TAPs on those has been strong. We hope to have our preliminary report up for public comment within the next 3, perhaps 4 weeks. And while I'm not at liberty to quite give it away yet, there will be a couple of the existing serious reportable events that will be suggested for retirement. And there will be a good number of these newly submitted SREs be proposed for inclusion on the SRE list, if not on the full list, perhaps in a couple of these specific environments. So we will make sure that you all are aware when that draft report goes up for public comment, and we would encourage your input and strong feedback on that. So I'll conclude my report with that. And I won't take questions right now because we do want to, we got a late start with the name rolling and all that stuff. But I do want to get to our next presentation. And a main focus for today's meeting was this whole issue of validating the data, auditing, how do you know you're getting full reporting, what's the accuracy of that which is recorded. We've been very lucky in having three presenters agree to give their perspectives on it. We've asked them to give us brief discussions. Eric will run the PowerPoint slides for us if you're on the webcast. And again, I'll ask each individual to give a little bit of a brief introduction to themselves, and we'll go in order as we have them listed on the agenda. So we have Stacy Mitchell from the Pennsylvania Department of Health. We've got Kathleen Billingsley from the California Department of Public Health, and then we've got Vanessa Day, who I recently met on the Medicaid issues as it relates to all of this. And so we'll start with Stacy, and we'll go through each individually, and then we'll have open discussions after all three presentations. So, Stacy?
Great, thank you. Sorry to interrupt, Stacey. This is Eric. If each presenter could just say next slide as we go along. And yes, this should be quite good to hear about issues in auditing and data validation, specifically with regard to data accuracy and analyzing the reports and then under-reporting.
Okay. Thanks, Eric. And thank you, everyone, for being here. This is my first time, so I will try not to be redundant and try to address everything that I think you're interested in. Just very quickly, Pennsylvania has two laws in place that create event reporting. The first one was Act 13, applies to hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers. And then in 2007, Act 13 was actually amended with Act 52, which is specific and unique to healthcare-associated infections. And the good thing that Act 52 did is it made by default an HAI an automatic serious event that must be reported by hospitals and nursing homes. Next. Now, I'm sure all of you have had experience with laws that leave some room to be desired for change or create interpretation issues. We have three categories of things to report. The first is an incident, which is best described as a near miss. The next one is an infrastructure failure, which is generally around the physical plant security and operations of a facility. Next. And then the probably arguably the most important one is a serious event. And this definition causes us some problems here in Pennsylvania because it leaves things open to interpretation. And as a regulator, you don't like a whole lot of interpretation. You want the law to be as clear and black and white and unambiguous as possible. And unfortunately, that's not what we have. So this is the definition of a serious event. There are basically three components that cause the most consternation. One is unanticipated. The other is causing an injury. And then the last one is additional health care services. And there are lots of lawyers who, I won't say lots of lawyers, there are some lawyers who work for some facilities who spend some time trying to figure out how things don't qualify as a serious event and therefore must not be reported in Pennsylvania. One of the reasons they spend time on this is that in Pennsylvania you have to serve the patient with a letter from the institution that says a serious event has occurred. And that is a med malpractice bonus here, and so I think that's why they spend some extra time trying to get out of having to report. Because of that, if you go to the next slide, then these are just some crude numbers here, but because we have some countervailing forces about reporting and it's not a completely blame-free, zero-consequence reporting system, we have to spend some time going out there trying to find them. If you look at the serious events that were reported, I took the volume from the Patient Safety Authority report, and I took patient data from the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment, and you come up with about 4 per 1,000 admissions, discharges, however you want to look at it. The healthcare-associated infection is a little bit higher than that. I guess the good news is these are rare events. The bad news is that none of us can afford to send somebody out there to plow through 500 charts to find two that someone has failed to report. Given that perspective, we have to try and figure out a better way to catch people at underreporting or failing to report and make examples of them. So I'll just leave this slide here, Eric. Thanks. What we've done in Pennsylvania is, I'm sorry, I have one more, don't I? Yes, I do. One more slide. Thank you, Eric. We take complaints as the regulatory authority licensing all of these institutions, and some of them are from patients, some of them are from families, some of them are from disgruntled employees. Occasionally, some of them are from legitimate whistleblowers. These tend to be a tremendously valuable source of information. I'm not saying they're always 100% right, but it helps pinpoint a problematic floor, procedure, surgeon, condition that helps our surveyors go in and narrow the field to what it is that we're trying to look at, so that we can do an audit and find out what's going on. We have two that we'll be taking action against in Pennsylvania. One came to us as a whistleblower complaint. She felt that she was not being allowed to report as honestly as the act required. She was partly right. She was partly wrong, but there was enough there for us to peel back the layers and pull some audits. It was centered around HAI, so we got laboratory value data, and then we're able to go back and validate the HAI through the chart review. But it's a very, as you know, chart review is an expensive way to go about it. So that was a relatively small hospital, and we were able to uncover several, and we will be finding that institution shortly. I can't tell you about it now because it's not public yet, but as soon as it's available, I'll let you all know what's going on. The other that we've had to set up through the HAI, and we use NHSN for our reporting here in Pennsylvania, and we report more HAI than any other state that I'm aware of. They have to report HAI completely and totally housewide, any HAI that occurs. And so we had over almost 26,000 HAI reports in hospitals in 2009 in Pennsylvania. And the data in NHSN, because it's a live environment, and because of the complicated way that the institution set up the permission for agencies and others to view data, it's a very, very complicated beast to live with. And we have six full-time employees here in Pennsylvania who spend pretty much most of their time trying to stabilize the NHSN data so that we can analyze it. We have created what we call data integrity and validation reports that we send out every quarter, and those go through the NHSN data. We look for required fields that are blank, data discrepancies where the infection happened prior to the admit date, invalid locations, missing denominator data, procedures like hysterectomies performed on male patients, anything that could be an anomaly. We also have to look for missing data. If you have an institution that has been reporting hip procedures all along and then suddenly they stop doing it for 3 months, you have to pick up the phone and ask the question, because if they don't put the HPRO code in their monthly plan, they're entering that data and we can't see it. And so they have to go in and correct their monthly plan. So we spend a tremendous amount of time trying to get all of this in place. And I think it has some good effects, but I have to tell you, it takes a lot of constant care and feeding. He who made a mistake 1 month is quite likely to make it 6 months or 9 months from now as the infection control personnel seems to change. But this data integrity has led us to another investigation where we found an institution just suddenly had stopped reporting denominator data. When we picked up the phone and asked why, we found out that they no longer had an infection control professional. They were recruiting for someone. And so they just stopped reporting for about 5 months. And that's another institution that we will be making an example of. We've taken the position in Pennsylvania that you're not going to get in trouble for reporting. You're not going to get in trouble for what you report. But you will be in trouble if you fail to report or if you fail to care about and learn from the data that you report. So I do believe that there's a time and a place to fine institutions, but I think fining from a regulatory perspective is something that has to be used judiciously. Otherwise, if you scare them and the consequences of failure to report and they go underground, I'm not sure how any of us are ever really going to get to the truth of it if they don't report honestly and robustly. Lastly, we're doing audits. We hope to be expanding and leveraging our technology. We use a lot of WebEx, which will allow us to view inside electronic medical records with the permission and security of the institution, so that we don't have to have people in the field down in the dungeons plowing through medical charts. And then we have other data sources that we're also hoping to leverage. I mentioned PHC4, it's the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council. They receive claims data from all of the hospitals in Pennsylvania. And that's a wealth of information there. And also to enlist the aid of the insurer market in Pennsylvania. They don't always know when they're being presented with an HAI claim or an HAI request for additional lengths of stay, but sometimes they do, depending on their payment arrangements. And if they know about it and they can be another source of eyes and ears that would report to the state agency, that would help us in creating sort of a multifaceted, broad-based surveillance so that institutions would be reluctant to fail to report because somehow someone else is going to find out about it and then they'll face a fine. So with that, I'll stop talking.
Well, great. Nice, succinct, strong resources. Again, as we know, we continue to look at Pennsylvania as a highly committed state and one that performs very well in all of this. And again, your presentation reflects that. So thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Kathleen from California, you heard that there was no belief in fining, but you guys are embarking on that course.
Yes, well, thank you very much for allowing me to present today. I'm Kathleen Billingsley. I'm the Deputy Director, as the slide says, for the Center for Healthcare Quality at the California Department of Public Health. And I have three slides to start with just to give you an overview of what has been reported in California since our legislation went into effect July 1st, 2007. So we'll look at the first slide. And in that slide, you can see we had the first year 940 reports. And the most frequently reported event for the first 3 years has been stage 3 and 4 decubitus ulcer acquired during the hospital admission. And you can see here of the 940, 572 actually fall into that category.
Hmm.
The legislation required us to use these particular events, which at that time were the NQF events, with the exception of one, which is, I must admit, my least favorite event, which is adverse event or series of adverse events, because that's not very well defined. And when we went live the very first year, it was actually, I called it kind of the other bucket, which means if you didn't quite know where it should go and someone called you with an adverse event, you just put it in this category. So if from a data integrity standpoint, that was certainly difficult. But I just ask you to keep in mind that number 940, because one of the things that we want to talk about today is underreporting, but also data accuracy. And what we had at the end of June of 2008 was almost 1,300 reported events. But basically what we found was that we only had 940 events that meet the criteria in the legislation, but we had hospitals that were fearful of not reporting in many cases, and so we actually had over-reporting initially. And I'm sure we also had a significant amount of under-reporting because that's been the primary issue since 2008. So again, the number, the second most frequently reported event in this year, that particular time period, was retention of a foreign object, followed by medication errors, and then death associated with a fall. So we'll look at the next year, which is 08 through 09. Again, stage 3 and 4 decubitus ulcers were the most frequently. Then retention of a foreign object, you can see that went up quite a bit. Death associated with fall, and death during or up to 24 hours. Then we'll go to the next slide, and you see that, again, this particular year, we had 1,558 events that have been reported, and followed by our two leaders. This time we have the category I was referring to earlier, which is adverse event or series of adverse events. And we'll talk about that category in just a few minutes when we go to the next slide. The first thing that we had when we brought our system live was, is the reported event actually an adverse event? And this became very much a challenge for us and for the providers. So the providers, in many cases, were, again, fearful of not reporting. So they reported some really interesting events. Those events were required that they be reported by statute in California as under the term a hospital unusual occurrence. But prior to this legislation going into effect, we had very few unusual occurrences that were reported to us. So we were really bombarded with the number of events that came our way very quickly. And by law, we are required to conduct an on-site investigation of each of these events in California's hospitals. So it became an issue for the provider because there was a lack of clarity and confusion. It also became a big program issue because we were basically investigating events that we thought were adverse events but were not. At that same time in 07, the California Hospital Association developed a standard reporting template which was used, which provided us with very little information to determine whether it was an adverse event. So we had to conduct a lot of outreach. Basically, we had to call the hospital for every single event. Knowing that we had this issue, we created a major provider communication piece. We told them that if they had reported an event that really was not an adverse event, that we were reclassifying them as such, and just took them back to and helped them, reminded them of the legislation and asked them to basically look at every event that was being reviewed and determine whether or not it really qualified as an adverse event. We also told them that this would really help us in the prioritization of our investigation and that we really wanted to be consistent and apply the law correctly, and that we need not necessarily conduct an investigation on site for every event. I think that reminder in itself was, I think, instrumental in improvement in our adverse event reporting. We'll go to the next slide. And in this case, basically what we have done, because of the fact that we had that over-reporting initially, or incorrect reporting actually, we have a research unit with a nurse there, and that particular nurse is responsible for reviewing that one category that I referred to, which is an adverse event or a series of adverse events, because it was used so incorrectly to categorize events. And so a registered nurse goes through every single one of those events on an ongoing basis, and then we reclassify them as needed. The program itself basically has a data cleanup process here, and because we really only post on the first three slides I show you the substantiated adverse events, which basically is, was it or was it not an adverse event? So we basically do some good clean, cleanup work here. But we have, I believe that just the provider outreach itself was very effective in terms of improving the quality of the data that is being submitted. We'll go to the next slide. One of the other things we had, and I think that my big claim to fame with David Berwick was that a year after adverse events went into place, one of the reporters from the Los Angeles Times, which gets a pretty wide reading and has a lot of people who comment on many different issues, we released our first report on adverse events, and Mr. Berwick pointed out to the world that he really felt that California had a serious underreporting issue. And, of course, he was quite accurate. In California, we have 400 general acute care hospitals. Some of approximately 320 of them have single licenses, and the remainder has one license but actually has multiple hospitals under that license. We also have great variances in terms of the reporting hospitals located in our 15 different district offices throughout California. So we have some quite a bit of variability in terms of reporting. I initially did kind of a real quick look at the number of licensed beds per district office and the number of events. And if you do that or you look at discharge days, which is one of the other ways of doing this, of course, probably far more effective way, is that you can see in quite a variety amongst the number of reported events throughout the state. And then we also had the provider communication. And what we do with the underreporting piece of this is we do send out reminders for mandatory reporting. our field offices can go ahead and contact the hospital administrators themselves just to remind them of the fact that they do have to report. And then we also publish our failure to report penalties. Now, we have a time frame, which is 5 days after an event is detected. It needs to be reported to the California Department of Public Health. And if it is not reported in a timely manner, there's a $100 a day penalty. And since we launched this program, as I said, in July of 2007, we've issued penalties in the amount of over $1.2 million. We actually even had one new CEO come on board and discovered that there were some very serious events that had not been reported by the hospital, and he reported them several months, actually, after the time that they were detected. Next slide. So what we really immediately became aware of is that we did have hospitals in the first year who did not report any events. Some were rural hospitals in California, some were small hospitals, and some were major institutions. So that's why we basically did the outreach to remind people about underreporting. But one of the first things that that I found in my communication with the hospital community is that if we went back as the Department of Public Health and told them that there was significant underreporting, there would be some healthy skepticism as to what really is underreporting and how did we come up with this. So we decided to go ahead and contract with Patrick Romano, who's over at UC Davis, which is very close to Sacramento, and started to talk to him about underreporting. So we are right in the process now of completing a contract with UC Davis to have them go ahead and conduct this analysis of our adverse events. Unfortunately, in California, we do not have a budget, and so once we get a budget, we can actually execute this contract. So sometime, hopefully in the next 30 to 60 days, we can actually launch this project. But the intent is to look at our huge database in California that has patient discharge data set information, look at the ICD-9s, look at the other codes, and do this analysis of underreporting. So UC Davis has agreed to provide us with a final report on adverse event reporting in California, which we, of course, will publish on our website. There will be an in-depth analysis of any potential underreporting of any particular types of events, as well as looking at these regional variations, which I spoke of earlier. And I think that this will be the most credible approach that we can take in California for presenting this information. I think it will create a bit of a stir because adverse event reporting in California is mandatory, and because of the fact that we have the failure to report caveat as well. So I think it's going to create a lot of healthy discussion, as they would say, regarding underreporting. And we'll go to the next slide. I have been very interested in participating in these calls and in the meetings with the other states and with everyone here because of the fact that I really would like to look more at auditing processes. But the number of events that we have makes it difficult to go through them. It's not automated in such a way that makes it easy for us to look at the data that's actually collected when we do the on-site investigations. We pulled out 2 years of data on retention of a foreign object and handed it to a team of about 5 or 6 nurses who reviewed that. And that was very enlightening for us to determine, first of all, what were the types of objects that were identified. We also looked at whether or not patients had been informed by the hospital of the adverse event. So, but that's very obviously manual processes really aren't the best way to go. So we're really trying to look at how we're going to audit this in a more effective manner. I still do have concerns that we are getting reports of events that are not adverse events, and so I think that we're going to sit down and look at that again, probably this next coming year, to determine, you know, how we should kind of tackle that. But any other states' auditing tools or processes or any feedback anybody else has, I would love to hear. The only other thing that I heard about underreporting was the process that I believe Minnesota has used, seeking an attestation by the hospital administration that they have reported all of their adverse events, as well as not just signing the bottom line as the CEO, but basically confirming that they have taken a proactive approach of looking at their own data to determine whether or not they have actually looked at all that and then reported the events to the Department of Public Health or to whoever they have to report to. So I think that will be one of the next steps that we'll be launching this coming year in California. So any other options or program options anybody has, I would love to hear. And with that, I'll go ahead and conclude my presentation.
Thanks, Kathleen. Lots of things going on in California, obviously, and sure there are some states on the conference that would be happy to have the problem of over-reporting rather than the one we all struggle with the under-reporting. We did get a 15-minute delay in our start as we tried to get everybody collected, so we are running a bit behind on our schedule, and I apologize for that. However, we have Vanessa Day from the Medicaid segment of CMS, and she's been very patient since this is the first time she's been on one of our calls. So I would still like to go ahead with Vanessa's presentation if she's willing, and that'll take a few moments, and obviously it'll truncate some of our discussion. But I appreciate everybody's enthusiasm on the presentation so far. So, Vanessa, I'm not sure. Do you still have time in your schedule to do this, or do we need to think about rescheduling you?
No, I do have time to speak briefly. As you probably know, we are in the reg writing phase now, so there isn't a lot I can say. My name is Vanessa Day. I am from CMS in the financial management group. I am actually less of a quality person, more of a payment person, but fast becoming a quality person. And I would like to say thank you very much, Eric, for including me in this call, because I've learned so much in this last hour and a half just about reporting, and that's been very important to my research. So thank you, and I hope I can participate again. As everybody probably knows, I hate to be redundant, but Medicaid has been charged with implementing a payment adjustment for health care acquired conditions that is somewhat akin to Medicare's hospital acquired conditions regulations and statute. And so right now we have been charged also with looking into how states currently prohibit payments for health care acquired conditions and incorporating practices that are I guess kind of best practices or beneficial to the process into the Medicaid regulations. In considering what states are doing, we are also looking at reporting requirements across the country. And so when given the opportunity to listen in and possibly speak on this call, we jumped at the chance. Right now, like I said, we are in the writing phase, but we have issued a survey to all states that was published in the Federal Register, I think on June 12th maybe, was published in the Federal Register trying to get information from states about different issues, including payment and reporting and the processes for how states have identified healthcare acquired conditions. I know that folks on this call are eager to find out how Medicaid would like states to validate data and determine what levels should be identified as non-payable. And the truth of that is that we are still working on that and figuring that out, and would be very pleased to have your comments on our survey or on our proposed rule that will be published kind of eventually. And so I know we want to get to another part of the call, so I'll wrap it up there, since I really can't say a lot about it anyway.
That's just fine, thank you for providing the slides. That provides us with some more information. In some of my discussion with Vanessa a couple weeks back, I was actually encouraged at the degree of effort that the Medicaid side of CMS is making. And as we all know, the Medicare side is moving along and creates lots of major change for the reporting side as through the payments initiatives overall. We have, I hope, a few questions or some comments. I know we're at the end of our hour and a half, but we have had an awful lot of information come out. And so are there any comments or questions in general?
Hi, this is Ann Flanagan in Maine. And first of all, I really appreciate, again, this is such a wonderful opportunity for all of us. I have not been able to be on the web, so is it possible to have the slides that were shown today sent to us?
Well, by all means, sure.
That would be great. And the other question and comment, I have a question for Kathleen. Hi, Kathleen. About the new CEO who reported his old Sentinel events or old serious adverse events. Was he fined for those events that were old?
Yes.
He was. Okay. I think that would be an interesting discussion to have at some point.
Well, he really felt as though he needed to make a statement to the employees of the hospital. So regardless of what the cost was, I don't remember what it was exactly, but he just felt like he needed to make sure that they knew that going forward, if it's mandatory and it's required that they report, they will report.
I think it was a very courageous thing for him to do, and it makes you wonder about amnesty and that kind of thing to encourage that type of conduct.
Exactly. I agree.
The other topic, which we probably don't have time for today, but I would really like to hear from the other states about the possible use of incident reports to identify cases, and whether anybody's had experience with that.
What do you mean exactly by to define cases?
In terms of what data and what sources we have to identify cases with regards to underreporting, hospitals use incident reports that are usually generated at the sharp end, as they say, at the time of the event, and those are possible sources of data to mine cases.
This is Diane from Minnesota. I would say, we don't have access to a facility's incident reports to use them for that purpose, but one thing that we are considering doing, I think someone just mentioned, I think Kathleen just mentioned that, we do an end-of-year attestation. We require facilities to sign off on a report. The CEO has to sign off on a report every year that says, yes, these are the only events that I had, and there are no others that were underreported. We want to expand that a bit so that we're asking them to tell us what data sources they used to make that determination that they really had all events. And so that would be one thing we would ask about was, did they review all incident reports? Did they use a trigger tool? Did they use other means to come to that conclusion that they had complete reporting for their facility? But we wouldn't be able to access the incident reports ourselves.
Diane, I'm intrigued. This is Ann again. I'm intrigued that you say that because in Maine we're struggling over that very issue right now about whether or not the state can access the incident reports. And the state of Maine is taking the position that the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Services can access incident reports. We're pushing pretty hard on that.
In Maryland, we can. We have used the incident reports for review in Maryland when we have a hospital that hasn't reported or rarely reported. And we have found, you still have to do some case review because the incident report just leads you to a patient. Mm-hmm. And then you still have to review the event to get the whole detail and the information on the record to figure out what's going on. We've also used mortality and morbidity review committee meetings at the hospital, things like P&T committee reviews, quality review minutes, that type of thing, to see if we can find cases that have not been identified by the hospital and reported to us.
Well, this is Diane. Well, that's interesting. We've always assumed we don't have that kind of access as part of adverse events. You know, we administer our system very separately from our licensing division and our investigation arm, so it's not a part of our regulatory process. You know, if that were ever anything that we were to seek out, I think for us, we would only use an approach like that if we already felt that there were some pretty significant red flags.
That's what we do.
Reporting, yeah.
Right,
because we just wouldn't have the resources to.
We do that as well. This is Anne again. And just another source that we found successful are the reports coming from the Board of Medicine. When a physician is sanctioned, on occasion, we have found that that determination may be attached to an adverse event, and we have fined for that.
Yeah, we do that as well. Our statute requires reporting to us by the professional boards if they become aware of anything that might be an adverse event.
We also in Maryland get copies of the lawsuits that are filed against the hospitals, but it's they're reported to us after they've settled. So sometimes by the time we get the information, it's so old that it's really hard to act on that through patient safety.
Mm-hmm. And I guess this is a question. This is Diane. I know that there will be minutes or notes from this call that go out, but I wonder, is there anything that NQF can do around maybe a quick survey in this area where we can get a better assessment of who's using what approach and some tools that they've used or some issues they've run across with a particular strategy for validation?
Yeah, I think we can do that fairly simply. It would be a fairly small survey with some open text, but we can do a SurveyMonkey to get some information going. It's a good idea. Thank you.
I think that's a great idea. That's Anne again. I think that's terrific.
So we could end up with sort of a here are best practices for, you know, validation, and here are some successful strategies.
And that's exactly where we're trying to go with this group overall, is, you know, not to just have reporting out, but to look for ways to work together, to learn from each other, et cetera. So it's a good idea, and hopefully we'll get it started. Other ideas, other comments?
This is John Clark from the Pennsylvania Patient Safety Authority.
Sure, John, go ahead.
I'd like to just bring up an issue that I haven't heard discussed, and it relates to both the presentations from Kansas and the presentation from California. I believe the implication was that there was not a lot of resources to produce any kind of output from these reports. I think one of the real drivers of getting people to report is that they actually see things happen, so that they actually see that the report has generated some kind of useful product, some recommendations, some advice, or something like that. And that is, at least in our experience, a very good driver of reporting.
Good point, John. Thanks very much. And hopefully others will be finding the same thing through that experience. I'm going to take a brief moment of pause because we are a few moments over to ask the operator to see if there are any public comments from our listening audience. I don't want to forget them in this whole process. Operator?
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question today, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. If you're joining us using a speakerphone, please ensure mute function has been turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is *1 on your telephone keypad. And we'll take our first question from Iona Thran with Utah Department of Health.
Hi, I was not included in the earlier discussion. I think I was treated as one of the public, so I just wanted to jump in quickly and say that the conversation you just had on the different ways of capturing the information that you were talking about. One of the things, and the non-reporters, one of the things that the people who are sitting at the table in our state are wondering, and it had me do twice now, is how many of the facilities are not reporting. And the as users who are actively participating and are actively reporting in the system, they're developing a growing concern about the ones who are not reporting. And so some of the conversation that you've just had has given me some ideas in terms of possible leveraging with the industry as a whole in terms of getting at these under-reporters or lack of reporting people. And I think bringing it to the users groups, because those that are acting in good faith are, you know, leading the way, leading the pack, so to speak, versus the ones that are lagging behind. And it might be good to leverage those that are acting in good faith in terms of some of these strategies if you don't have the regulatory authority, which I don't have in Utah.
Thanks, Iona, and our apologies for getting you caught up in the other line there, but your comments are certainly well-founded, and again, it drives home the point of this forum, because there is this free exchange of ideas and there's prompting of thoughts and other strategies that different groups can try based on what they hear here today. So thank you. Other comments or questions?
We do have one other question. We'll hear next from Rita Gallagher with American Nurses Association.
Thank you for the opportunity to listen in. And Peter, I'd just like to call this the attention of this group to the work of the National Coordinating Council for Medication Error Reporting and Prevention, which has taken a position in opposition to the reporting of error rates. And that position is available on the website at nccmerp.org. Thank you.
Thanks, Rita, for that information, and we'll certainly have a look at that again.
Peter, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, hi, this is Mike Baring with Pennsylvania Patient Safety Authority.
Yeah, hi, Mike. By all means, go ahead.
Just wanted to make one quick point. Even though we're not regulatory, and Stacey Mitchell, as you heard before, she does the regulatory stuff in our state. One thing we did do years ago was we figured out who our lowest 50 reporters were in terms of reporting rates for non-harm and harm events, and we sent them all letters to their CEOs. And reporting from those 50 hospitals increased by 225% from 10,000 reports to 31,000 reports between 2008 and our most recent year. And so it's just, I guess it was just paying attention because we can't do anything to them.
Did you, what did you ask for in the letter?
We didn't ask for, we told them, we said, we told them why reporting is good and what we use all the information for in terms of education and training. And we said, you're receiving this letter because either you didn't send us this type of report last year or another type of report last year, or you are in the bottom, or I think it was, you are lower than 50% of the mean in terms of reporting rate. And we left it at that.
And I'd like to jump in. Basically, what Michael's saying is that when you tell people they're not reporting, they view it as a negative and they want to report more rather than as a positive and say, oh, goody, we're doing a great job.
Right. And it was specifically in incidents, which are non-harm events, which we collect in Pennsylvania, that they really reported a lot more of. So we're hoping that, you know, all of those efforts continue to change the culture in the hospitals in Pennsylvania.
Well, great example. Thanks, Mike and John. It, again, reemphasizes the importance of engagement by leadership in these organizations, and even a simple letter throughput creates big change. Good example. Thanks. Well, this has, I appreciate all that have stayed on past our scheduled time. Even though we've got this 15-minute delay, I'm going to stop us at 15 minutes past our time. So that we're at least trying to stay on schedule to some degree. I would like to thank all of you for your participation. If you have comments on how we can refine these conference calls, less presentations, more dialogue, those sorts of things, by all means, send them through to us. We need the feedback in order to make these better. They're here for you, not for us. And I would like to specifically thank each of the presenters who took some time to be with us, but also the time and effort it took to put some slides together and to get their thoughts together to give us those succinct presentations. So thank you to everybody. And so with those as closing comments, I'll bring the conference call to a close. Eric will help us with some summary notes as well as some follow-on survey work, and we'll begin our planning for the next conference call in the next 6 to 8 weeks. So thank you all again, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference call. We thank you for your participation.